would like to first. I was asked to make a brief cover of the basic theory, which been discussed here for some weeks, but not everyone was present here for that time. And I will focus my theory only on the case of multi-site. Only on the case of multi-site theory, and only on the case of fixed S. That will be the first part of the talk. So to remind, because Klaus reminded what is quasi-species theory, I might as well remind what is clonal interference. So the clonal interference is a situation when we have selective sweeps in the system which overlap in time. If you have sufficient number of sites or population size is large, selection sweeps do not happen consecutively but overlap. And they have to stand in line, being fixed in population. So in this situation, either they simply compete because they have different selection advantages, strongest guy wins. And that's in the pairwise regime that was first described by Phil Gersh here. Most accurately, but I will focus on constant S case, and in that case the only way we can resolve this competition and is to grow inside of each other by growing clones instead of clones. As a result, you have so many clones that you can't really keep track of them that easily, and you have to resort to some sort of statistics. And first of all, you have to classify sequences according to fitness classes. Then you will study how these fitness classes consist from clones of different size. And then investigate the clone structure of these fitness classes. And then move from there to more detailed characteristics. But everything starts from a simple fitness description, which usually traditional population geneticists, especially in the beginning of all these activities, and especially experimental biologists, dislike so much. So counterintuitive to them and so unconceptual, just mathematics. I said just mathematics, it's not conceptual. But nevertheless, it's getting conceptual when it gets to the concept, nevertheless, exists. And the concept is called traveling wave, first put forward by UCSD physicists Simring, Levine, and Kessler. And I have a considerable portion of my talk is going to be on whiteboard. The idea essentially was that if you study the simplest case of number of sequences in clone with mutation number k. K is a number of deleterious mutation. Then that number is a function of time. Is going to follow the simplest case of landscape with an identical selection coefficient. Plus mutation term, including case more deleterious mutation, less deleterious mutation, including transition from classes with less mutations and transition classes from more bad alleles. Right? That's pretty much it, except selection, and that would be the average size of classes. But of course, you have to get here a random drift to keep in mind that every generation, this describes only the average values.
What about mean fitness?
K average.
K average.
Ah, I think.
Right, that what preserves the normalization.
Do you give negative terms to compensate? Again, do you give terms of minus ud plus ub and k?
That's correct. And of course, thank you for reminding, there is a loss of total mutation rate.
Is
that S one you tell me?
Is S negative here? Number of deleterious mutations, if that goes up, then
yes, if K is negative, is bad mutation, is not an S is negative.
That's positive.
No.
No? Now it will be positive. Good. Now everything, we fixed everything. All right. So the point was to notice that this equation, as well, this remains discrete, is not very convenient to solve. But when you're trying to get rid of discreteness, an issue arises whether nk depends on k sufficient and sufficiently smooth fashion. Well, as we found out, there are different regimes with respect to that. And generally speaking, it doesn't depend on sufficiently smooth fashion. And I was trying to give kind of result of solving that equation. And the equation, if this is K mutation load, say, and this and fitness goes the other way, and we have discrete values of K, it turns out that in generally speaking, after sufficiently long time, that solution acquires a shape of solitary wave of asexual evolution, which sounds very sad, and that's why I like the title for this work. Although the title was invented by Wakely. So, and the wave can go either to the right or to the left. Of course, its width is connected with its speed according to Fisher theorem. Let it be directed towards fitness increase, which in this case is going to be variation of k. Right. And the question is what this speed is. And as I said, the wave, even if it behaves sufficiently smoothly in the middle, at the flanks decays exponentially fast, so that nk is not equal to nk minus 1, approximately. As a matter of fact, we found that in the ratchet regime, when v is smaller than zero, when it accumulates deleterious mutations, we always have, almost always have nk over nk minus 1, sort of not close to 1. At high fitness age, which matters, this value is sort of would be more like some factor which is larger than 1. And that means in the ratchet regime, you never can consider k as a continuous variable. And for the adaptation case, that you, it can be, the slope can be even much larger than 1, provided v is much larger than ub. I'm considering here a case when deleterious mutation rate is 0, for example. Suppose there is no deleterious mutation rate, just beneficial mutation rate. Then it will be, turns out that if v is larger than ub, larger than beneficial all genomic mutation rate, then the slope is so steep, very steep, and it's certainly continuous k would be a very bad approximation. And then we decided that the best approach would be to take the best fit class. That basically it means two things. First of all, is that the best fit class, which is present in population, is much smaller than the next fit class. So, and I call it K0. So NK0 is much smaller than NK0 plus 1. And that's what only one class maybe should be considered stochastic. If it's around, somewhere around or larger than stochastic threshold of one locus theory, which is equals to basically 1 over that fitness advantage, 1 over S K0 minus KL. That was the idea. And next will be much higher than stochastic threshold, and therefore we can already neglect with the drift for it. And that was the idea, to take a single stochastic class. I believe it was the most important idea in the entire work. And the rest is just mathematics. To take a single stochastic class, right? So, laughter was not about my statement, but about my reluctance to use my
People understood world, not work.
Yeah. You said it was the best idea in the world. But they understood it was the best idea in the world.
Let's see. So how do I... Okay.
He leaves it ambiguous.
Maybe in the world, too. Anyway, right. This paper was written very densely, but what Klaus in 5 years found it among Dead Sea Scrolls. Cleaned it and translated into modern English. I guess that became more known in that version. All right. So, as I said, and that is a traveling wave regime. We have a single stochastic class. If, however, only if V is much smaller than beneficial mutation rate, which makes sense to consider if selection coefficient is much smaller than beneficial mutation rate, then there is a regime of very small speeds, small population sizes, where continuous landscape approach, which was original approach introduced by Simmering et al., investigated further by Brunet, at all, in which case you consider many, you have a smooth stochastic tip, which you sort of introduce heuristically at the level when you have on order of one genome. And recently, Oscar had a very interesting development of this work. He basically solved the problem exactly, as I understand it. Replacing heuristic cutoff with exact nonlinear ending. You just normalize not the wave, but the distribution of ancestors for the future. Wave will fluctuate, ancestors will not. And in that case, cutoff is chosen for exact solution. So that is a continuous landscape. But for the rest of the situation, right, and in this case, when landscape is continuous, because wave is smooth, you can also treat mutations in the bulk very easily. You can mutate it, split it in two parts. One is shift, simple shift term, linear in K, which later adds up into, so NK on T equals M on K minus VT, right? So then it adds up, shift to add up to the speed V. And the second part which is left is essentially has a form which can be replaced with a diffusion, normal diffusion presentation, linear operator. In that case, we have a completely linear deterministic operator plus some noise, some white noise in the, which becomes important in the stochastic tip. Now, in the traveling wave regime, you have a single stochastic class, as I said, and you cannot really, and you really have a Poisson fluctuations and formation of new classes by adding to it copies consecutively, and that's how the system progresses forward. The idea is that once the class adds more than copies in excess of stochastic threshold, the wave can progress forward. That was the crude idea, that you have to exceed stochastic threshold at which a class is fixed with probability 50%. According to one locus theory with that sort of number of copies. As far as treatment mutations in the bulk was concerned, another working idea turned out to be that you cannot treat NK continuously, but you can treat continuously its logarithm. As a result, you will have e log n k plus e, and people sitting on the right, of course, do not see it, so let's make it fair. N k plus 1 equals n k e d log n k over d k, approximately. And then, and you do have a continuous function log, except it's an exponential, it's not linear. So you have to work with a nonlinear solution, which is not solvable in general case, but all important properties such as connection between speed and k0 and k0 minus k average can be extracted from it analytically. So it's partially solvable, essentially, for practical purposes. All right. Now, as a result of these activities, so not diffusion, but some nonlinear operator. And as a result of these activities, we obtained Miller's ratchet, accumulation of deleterious mutation in the area such that n is much smaller than 1 over s e power ud over s. This is suppose, and steady state as well. Somebody was asking after Klaus' talk when population size in steady state stops being important. That's right. So if UD is, for example, 10 minus 1 and S is 10 minus 3, here is e power 100. That's pretty large. If, of course, S is on order of UD, that then this area of ratchet disappears, shrinks. That's first. And second, we obtain adaptation, right? Which basically was written as V over, convenient to write as MUB equals V over half log square V over E UB, something plus 1, which is not very important. E here is 2.71828. The reason I remember it, because Leo Tolstoy was born at the year 1828. That's right. We teach P in Russian. So, because everyone remembers when Tolstoy was born, right?
Speak for yourself.
Okay, fine. I remember because of P. But so, the crude part here was this factor UB. In fact, a more accurate value turns out to be square root of SUV, okay? Divided by some log, which I don't want to write. And that factor, that accuracy becomes important if NUB is on order 1 somewhere, or on order of square root of S over UB. And that accuracy, that period, which corresponds to V smaller than S, but larger than S log, SUV. And that interval was studied in great detail and by the Zion Fisher, which wrote a wonderful 40-page manuscript on that. And
that's ignoring
the paper. Right, that's ignoring. Actually, you can easily put it here. That's very easy. It just plus UD. And that's it. And that follows from the equation, which number I don't remember, but it's written there as a most general form of answer. If you simply you have to put there k over l, which is denoted alpha, which is also u b over u b plus u d, you have to take limit to zero. That's what you have to do. Then you obtain that thing. Yeah, formula like that. So not to zero, but consider it much smaller than one. I'm sorry. Otherwise, you won't get UB in the answer. So you have to proper take the limit. That's all. And so it's interesting that in this intermediate area you can neglect mutations in the bulk completely. They are not important, and you can. Take mutations only when they generate new fitness classes at the very edge. Okay, then very sophisticated for that time derivation was applied to calculate what happens with a stochastic age. Sophisticated as compared to stochastic threshold, and given its length and generality. Outside of this interval, however, this thing doesn't work because it neglects its mutations in the bulk primarily, and because of some other technical issues with back extrapolation. Then what we did, we first of all upgraded our work, our treatment of stochastic age, 2008, replacing branching process with three-line argument, and showed the accuracy is essentially the same. And the reciprocative thing, in another work with Brunet as the first author, we fixed some technical problems with the Zion-Fisher approach. And after that, our approach started to apply in this intermediate range with the same accuracy. And the Zion-Fisher approach, after being fixed by Eric, started to work very numerically, not asymptotically, but in very broad range in that regime. And everything became just full harmony.
Excuse me, one question.
Yes.
Regarding the ratchet regime, just what does the inequality actually mean? You have ratchet only when the inequality is satisfied.
Yes, if I have
long enough.
Not quite. If I outside of this regime, ratchet exists at any fine population size. Right. That's what we mean. But if it is larger than this value, it has a different nature. It's not described, first of all, by a formula which we obtained for ratchet. It is exponentially small in population size, exponentially. While in our case, it's not exponentially small. It depends logarithmically.
You mean the speed of the ratchet?
The speed of the ratchet. And it contains on extremely rare clicks. Click, the system assumes mutation selection balance at a new position. Click. The system assumes mutation balance at new position. Rare clicks. While in this regime, it's a click, 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 and it doesn't have enough time to adjust to a new quasi-steady equilibrium. That classical ratchet, slow ratchet with rare clicks, was studied exhaustively by Wolfgang Stefan and Charlesworth and Gordo, Isabel Gordo, who left already. So.
Yes.
Great detail. So it was we simply call it quick ratchet. But differences just in frequency of clicks. Okay, and when comparing all these approaches, it's already final work by Brunet, at two different cases, two different values of UB is and broad range of population sizes, which are relevant for various viruses and microbes. Perhaps for bacteria, a piece is missing. Bacteria can be as large as 10 power 15. Not 10 power 23, as Dan wrote on his slides by accident. 10 power 15.
I was cheating. I was counting in all guts everywhere. So multiply by population size.
On the Earth?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so
I see.
Of humans.
Well, yeah.
Of humans. What about all the other
matters? Oh, I wasn't counting. Just the people.
Okay, fine.
The snob.
I know.
Interesting. Interesting opportunities arise. All right, anyway, for bacteria. UB, if people don't wash their hands. If UB equals 0.002. And then, so you can see that all approaches, while original design approach worked perfectly for intermediate and UB, and all approaches were of more or less the same accuracy, including improved solitary wave theory, including design Fisher and simulation shown by Dodds. And including this work means improved design Fisher and before improvement does. Everything was fine. When NUB is large, design Fisher showed very strong deviation because of technical issues mostly, not because of neglecting mutations actually, but after that was fixed, as you can see, it's actually greatly improved. So now everything is fine.
Igor, I would argue, I mean, you call it technical issues, but I think it's really neglecting mutations.
Really?
Yeah, neglecting mutations from the second class to the first class.
And from the second to the first? You mean from next bad fit to best fit?
Yes, from the mutations from the first deterministic class to the stochastic class. And what you call technical issues is exactly that they neglected those mutations.
I thought that it was a back extrapolation.
Yeah, it's the same thing. It was actually Igor's idea. the back extrapolation is exactly...
Okay. He is 50% right. When they calculated the growth of the class, they took it into account, it has to be taken into account twice, in one place and another. In one place they took it into account, another didn't. That what was it, right? As far as I remember. So basically, when they calculated the growth of the class, they calculated correctly. They took, of course, into account mutation, otherwise the wave wouldn't move.
Yeah, okay.
But when they back extrapolated, they pretended that this mutation do not exist, and that there is only selection.
Yeah.
So they forgot, the right hand didn't know what was left. Right, so they took it. So in essentially, yes, you're right.
But it's an approximation that works fine in the upper case, and it doesn't really work in the lower case. And the problem is, if you make the approximation, the math gets really easy.
Right.
If you don't make the approximation, which is the lower case, you need a genius like Eric to do the math correctly.
Yes.
And the math gets really, really nasty. But Eric was able to somehow...
pull it off.
Yeah.
Right. It was with incredible, yeah, let's say, anal precision. and that's actually the reason why I have this personal prejudice in favor of traveling wave, because it's just a three-line argument. Maybe you lose generality and maybe it's technically less rigorous, but it gives fine accuracy, just a three-line argument, and you don't need to have Eric around you all the time. Okay, and so that's why for future purposes, including recombination model, I'm using the stochastic threshold approximation. The worst can happen. You will lose some log and log. Fine. So basic, but not much. You won't get all those magnitude. All right. So although basic SX theory, after all this feat of mathematics, consisting of all this paper, it seems to be practically okay. For practical purposes, I'm not sure that everyone will agree, but at least we have something here which gives agreement. So we are in dire need of more detailed predictables than Seeley adaptation rate, which is not measurable in many cases anyway, and unless it's in culture. And which can be measured in sequences. And of course, the first thing comes to mind is coalescent. And we need coalescent for adaptation, we need inferential and steady states. Data are coming not only from microbes, data are coming from mitochondrial DNA of whale lice, if you know, if you read this work, which I'm referring to. the first author is Sager. So we need a coalescing. And unfortunately, I didn't have opportunity to read the preprint of Desai and Alexander, which I just downloaded from this site. So, but I'm going to talk to Michael when I'm back to Boston about that, hopefully. And we really need distributed S, for which no analytic theory exists at all. For two-side, yes. Field theory is famous. And now important corrections are calculated by Stefan from Mike Lacy group. But for multi-site, we have a simulation with extremely puzzling results, which we need all to discuss. But not now. And of course, epistasis are only emerging. That's, in my opinion, is the state of that field. And that refers to all kinds of, all three regimes which I mentioned. And then I will get next to rare recombination. Okay, 35 minutes. But at least the basics are set. Now, now we have that model, and imagine that we may or may not have mutation rate, but what is important here is that we have selection drift, and mostly asexual individuals, which recombine with a small probability. So individual has a small probability to recombine with another individual and have M crossovers per genome, producing progeny. What this M is, as it turns out, doesn't matter much as long as there is at least one. Strangely enough, in multi-site theory, M doesn't matter for many properties, but not all. There are, for LG, for example, it does. But for adaptation, it doesn't. Adaptation rate, it doesn't. Now, traveling wave, now we have a quasi, still we have a traveling wave with quasi-stationary profile with deterministic bar and stochastic age. The difference, however, is that N-genal adaptation is now is still extension of the age by new highly fit individuals, but they are not produced as a result of short-range changes in fitness space as by mutation, but by long shot in fitness space from far away, from the middle of distribution, as a result of recombination with parents. That's important difference. And that, of course, means that the precise shape and precise issues where the age become less important and age becomes less steep. And we don't have that situation when a single stochastic class only exists. So the age is quite different than in the case of mutation, because of the mutation which made it steep. You may or may not have a mutation in the system. Alleles may pre-exist and in addition be added by mutation. So if engine of adaptation is recombination, unless its recombination is extremely small, then mutation are fuel, which allows, alleles are fuel, which allow that thing to move. When you run out of alleles, they are fixed or lost, and the engine stops.
Peter?
Yes?
Would it only work for a combination done kind of eukaryotic style with crossovers, or it would be also done bacterial style where a chunk of DNA is being recombined into a chromosome, which would kind of, in eukaryotic language, would correspond to a two crossover points which are relatively short, you know, short distance away from each other on, compared to the genome size?
I think Richard and Boris have a better feel of that.
In this regime, it's better the same.
Because I thought much less about bacterial mold.
Well, there's some things that are a little different.
So the kernel recombination will not be identical, but thank you for the question. It's a good question because I have half of my labs are bacteriologists. Maybe I can appease them. Basket pointing out. Anyway, general framework. So in our works, three analytic work and one was just intermediate simulation which we produced over the period of 5 years, we actually set the general framework of how to handle this problem and apply this general framework to specific situation when with pre-existing alleles. So that's thing that what I failed to emphasize in the last work, that there are two things. There is a general approach, and there is a specific assumption that there is no mutation and all else pre-exist. So let's talk about general framework. So the main assumption is that distribution of progeny when log fitness around parents per each generation is Gaussian, with infinite tails and with a variant. Well, obviously they are not infinite, you would have somewhere they become Poisson, but sufficiently far out, a Gaussian with a variance. And I'm going to use notation of Necker and Schrein here for convenience. Given by genetic distance between genomes. This is not to be confused with the shape of population fitness distribution, because that has to be derived and that may vary depending on population size, recombination rate, and other parameters. But this is Gaussian, it's a very safe assumption. If you have sufficient number of sequences in population, simply very diverse population with many sites. Of course, if you have only two sequences, 0, 0, 0 and 1, 1, 1, then of course it doesn't work. But if you have a large number of sites, it's a very safe and general assumption, I would say. So, and then from that simple fact, instead of writing this recombination term, you can write, a mutation term, you can substitute this recombination term, which however is quadratic in NK, because parents come in pairs in this model of recombination. And then you can find many properties of the wave and express them in terms of sigma square alone. After you do, and that was the program which we did in this works. In the very end, after you do it, you can find sigma square from self-consistent condition. And what is it? It turns out that, so I will talk about adaptation. We talk only about adaptation, so in this setup, obviously all adaptation is possible. So V equals to sigma squared, right? Fisher theorem says. And we introduce parameter, most important parameter of all, which is equals to R. X0 divided by sigma squared. Where is 0? X0 is the same thing as previously, it's a cutoff of the wave. And I'm going to once again use notation of the three authors. If X is a relative fitness with respect to the average, and X0 is cutoff. This cutoff can be very easily shown to be equal to, 2 sigma squared log nr divided by square root of log nr, something like that. And the argument behind it is somewhat different from argument. It follows from stochastic threshold, but I'm not going to repeat it now. The whole point is that you generate recombinants at such rate that the H propulses forward at the same rate as wave moves. No, did I say correctly? That's a X0. Okay. And then beta has a very simple sense. Beta says that if you generate a recombinant at the very H, then as time goes in the frame connected to the middle of the wave, it moves to the left. And sooner or later, becomes average. So in that time, it's going to decay due to recombination with other sequences. So beta shows how much it decays. Am I right here? Or I missed something here? R x zero, R times distance divided by that, so R times time. That's correct. It's just the larger beta, the more it decays. So it's a clone decay parameter. It turns out that if clone decay parameter is large, that the system works as follows. That clone goes half a way exactly to x0, so small, sorry. Here, almost without decaying, and becomes part of parental zone, which has a width, the same width of the wave, sigma squared. Then these parents recombining between each other generate new clones nearby, and so on in a loop. But those which already gave birth become mature. So basically, if this is say 70 years, then 35 they have kids. Then they grow, have kids, or on. So the replication cycle happens here. And each fitness class mostly consists from a single clone born at the edge. If, however, your beta is large, then decay of clone is too large, and optimal parental zone is located closer to the middle, and optimal clones are kind of scattered, also kind of shorter, closer to parents. So we have shorter loops, birth loops, clones. In this case, each fitness class has many clones. Per class. So we have a different clone structure. How about the shape of the wave? In both cases, shape is Gaussian, except in this case, it is Gaussian precisely with sigma squared. How about the shape of the population? In this case, it's Gaussian, exactly, with the same width as the recombination kernel, sigma squared. In that case, it's also Gaussian, but with smaller width, where p is smaller than 1. Essentially, this is something like linkage disequilibrium, which is spread all over the genome. It's not a side-side. It's not zero. And here that value of p becomes exponentially small. So 1 minus p is an order of 1 log nr when beta is on order of 1. 1 minus p and beta are actually related. So we have difference in clone structure, we have difference in Gaussian width, and most interesting, if at the border between two systems we have non-Gaussian corrections, which reflects reconstruction of the clone structure from one type to another. So, and cutoff, those are features. Turns out that having this clone structure, you can find also ancestor fitness distribution, and under some simple approximations, coalesce, which we also did in this works.
Excuse me, how did you define sigma now? What is sigma?
Sigma is s squared divided by 4 times genetic distance. It's a variance of progeny between. I didn't write the kernel. Right. Let me write it. So E minus X minus X1 plus X2 divided by 2 square to sigma square. So per each generation step, if parents have fitnesses X1 and X2, a child has fitness X. That's the density, distribution density. That's the definition of sigma.
But sigma is still, according to that sentence, depends on X1 and X2.
Right. Those are the fitness differences, they're not the genetic distances. Because one, one guy could be fit because they have, you know, all the alleles on the right side of the chromosome, the other has all the alleles on the left side of the chromosome. Same fitness, but big genetic distance. Okay. And the idea here is that, if I'm correct, the genetic distance is basically constant. Everyone is about the same distance.
Yes, you're right.
Which breaks down if beta is small, because then two people with the same fitness are probably from the same clone.
Yes, you're right. I need additional assumption to claim that this is also related to genetic distances, that there is a uniform distribution of all genome.
Something like the mean genetic distance in the population?
Right. For example, even if they are heavily correlated, two sequences, it still applies. The sigma squared will be small. Mm-hmm. as it was in our case. But you don't need some sort of equivalence of size. Yes, of course, fitness is not. Thank you for noting this.
Okay.
Uniformity along is required. Symmetry, uniformity of size is required.
So uniformity of
sides.
But if beta was really small, so that if I specify a fitness class, you know the genotype basically, then that would not work, right? Because then sigma would depend on X.
Say it again.
Say beta is super small, so that even fairly close to the mean, fitness classes are dominated by single clones. Then if I had two of exactly the same fitness class mating, we would know their offspring's genotype.
You mean if parental zone is like one, with become like one? Yeah, of course, yes. Self-recognition is not required.
Yeah. But hopefully there's lots of X's you never mate with your own type, it's not important.
Yes, there is a lot of backup there, yes. Because I watched it not in terms of sigma square, but in terms of mutation load, so that mutation, this width is supposed to be sigma square divided by a square, supposed to be large. Mm-hmm. You should have large width. And X0 is even larger by log now.
So even when they're logiclonal, if someone is just in the next fitness class over, they have no relation to you.
Keep in mind it's larger square root of L, mm-hmm. where L is a number of sites, roughly speaking, participating. And if you have 1,000 sites, as in the system to which we're trying to apply, then that's pretty broad. 100 sites, or then even 10, I mean. So
sigma somehow represents the standing variation in the population that is pre-existing alleles, or?
Well, it depends on the number of segregating loci and
the frequency. Sigma, to what sigma is and what it represents depends on a specific problem. If, for example, you have very large recombination rate, very large population size, sigma squared will be given just by binomial distribution, right? S square L F 1 minus F, where F is a allelic frequency. That's binomial. That's the limit. And if the system is, if you still have L sites and they're still uniform equivalent, then that value is going to be decreased due to correlations by the between sites due to variation. I'm going to talk a little bit.
Yeah, so I was just confused because initially I thought it's sort of the standard deviation of the fitness distribution. But that's
no.
Standard deviation of the offspring fitness distribution.
No. It's an offspring per generation. That's why I put it. So distribution of progeny log fitness per each. This is not to be confused with the shape of population fitness distribution, which is derived.
Are you right? B equals to sigma squared?
Oh, yeah, that's misleading, yeah.
What?
V equals sigma squared. That's not the speed of the advance of the wave anymore. That is always the shape of the population fitness distribution. That is.
But that's some of the variance of the fitness distribution.
There we go.
Okay.
Sorry about that. In all cases I studied, P was always. Yeah, V is smaller than sigma squared. So wave is more narrow than the fitness of that. No, this is correct, but just don't look at it. Because it's misleading. So, all right, so those are the properties, basic properties which I just listed, and I just don't want to go into general properties. So we have cutoff, we have partly shrinking of distribution as compared to original sigma. And the nastiest part of that property is that we also have fluctuations. And why it's important, well, I'm not really comfortable to discuss now, but obviously the age fluctuates. Turns out that when you calculate, for example, density of coalescent events, then it is much more probable for two lineages go back in time and end up in the same clone if that clone is huge, because it's a square of that clone size. So you would end up in a typical situation, even if beta is large, when normally clones are small, but you will end up in a typical situation when clones are huge and occupy entire fitness class. So density of coalescent event comes from extremely rare events at beta larger than one. At beta much smaller than one, clones always are large. So that's not what at beta larger than one, they come from rare events. But if I will start talking about coalescent, that will take forever. So
with the clone size distribution,
right.
Is
clone size distribution at beta larger than one?
Yeah, what's the form of it?
Given that we have about 15 minutes,
right.
Maybe we should have the chance to go to the.
Okay. Maybe. Right. I did calculate. I don't remember the answer. It's written down. Well, anyway, I just wanted to say the value of sigma and what sigma is actually depends on what problem you solve. It always sounds out consistently. In stationary case, which was considered by the three authors, it's found from the condition that you inject and fix alleles at the same speed as well. Adaptation rate. And that determines the value of sigma. And in the case which I considered, which was transitory dynamics without mutation at L sites, which were all having pre-existing alleles in sufficient quantities, and I was interested how this initial fuel is being used to form a wave and propel this wave forward until finally alleles are getting lost or fixed, and no mutation. In that case, everything becomes more complex. In this case, sigma squared depends on time, slowly. So, fortunately, slowly, so it's the longest time scale. And you have correlations, and you have loss of alleles, and you need to introduce density of coalescent events. But currently, my main concern is about stationary case. And because in my last paper, I carried out this stuff from the very beginning, I guess that was the best way to consider it. Because that is one of possible applications of the general formalism, and not the simplest one. That one is, I would expect, is more transparent and maybe also practically important. All right. So we are discussing this, and we are. And no, I had no thoughts on how this connected to two-side theory for full sex. Then, so, but I hope, and how much sex we need to have a full sex. Okay, application to HIV. Finally. So I would like to point out that our recent manuscript, which represents simply honest simulation, which has everything which I said and recurrent mutations and distributed S, and develops a regional method of extracting parameters from data sequences from our collaborators, one time point, by the way, sequences. Estimate parameters in such a regime that speed of adaptation is not very far from beneficial mutation rate, which is pretty huge because enormous number of sites involved, and much larger than selection coefficient. So I really don't know. It looks kind of border between the regime which of solitary wave or even of whatever was considered by. PNS 2003 and TPP 2008, and if that would be asexual, I mean, and the continuous landscape regime. Recombination rate is important here, but it's small in the sense that it actually the speed is predicted to be 2-3 times faster than in the absence of recombination. but not awfully faster, only two or three times. And for like four times smaller than in the limit of unlinked loci at large R. So that was kind of our prediction, and it's kind of remarkably close to prediction obtained by Boris and Richard in their recent publication, as far as RN is concerned, but completely different method and completely different model. So I have no comments. They use longitudinal samples, they use different measure of linkage disequilibrium, and they use different models, more simple analytic models. So that's why, the reason why I'm mentioning it is because it is not completely untrivial which model to choose to describe each of you on in advance. Because I often hear statements like, this theory applies for RNA viruses, this for yeast. This is not true. For every single organism, UB can vary broadly depending on the number of adjusted sites. Anyway, if we would deplete virus load as compared to typical patients, then recombination would be much smaller because co-infection would not occur as often, and we would have get into ASX. Especially if patients are successfully treated and they have may have hidden pockets of replication, that we are even deeper into that regime. However, short-term evolution, such as occurs compensatory for drug resistance, is an entirely different story. S is much larger, will be much larger, it may be as large as 5%. UB will be much smaller by a couple of orders of magnitude, and we are certainly deep into traveling wave of stochastic H regimes. So before, depending on the problem which you are interested in, even for HIV in patients, you are in different, have to use different models, ASX or the recombination, and traveling wave or continuous landscape. That was my main point.
So on long-term evolution, the S values go down presumably because beneficial mutations are not, or sort of the large effect mutations are fixed.
Just there is a distribution of S, and you expect the long-term evolution employs larger value, smaller values of S. You use up the larger value of S faster. So the system runs out of them.
And so these values are measured. These are extracted from data, right?
This is extracted from data. This is not a guess. This is actually, we tried hard.
And the other ones on the next slide also are extracted from data. We say
right.
S is much larger than 1%.
Yes, for drug resistant, primary drug resistant mutations in the absence of drugs, that would be, I think, 5%, right? Typically.
I don't know.
That's why I'm asking. So but the compensatory, those each primary drug resistant mutation is followed by a cascade, say, of 10, 15 mutations. So L is much smaller, that's why UB is small. On the other hand, S in that cascade decreases gradually from 5%, and that's why you have S much larger than 1%. So we tables are turned, and we are certainly in very, very discrete regime.
It's not clear whether we get away.
Are you going to describe the data and the method that you used in infer these parameters?
No, not in this stuff. And we're actually waiting for it a little bit, even a couple of days.
We can talk about it later, I mean, if you want.
But we can show it, yeah. We have a manuscript. Dragging along the editorial board, I don't know why. So antigenic escape, basics. Do I have 5 minutes? Okay, let's run through it really fast. Genome have several dozens of eight, now think about CRISPR, because you already heard about them several times. Alan presented data on antigenic escape, but that was when many of people were not here, but I recommend to go to his talk and look at it again. So genome have several dozens of 8 codon long pieces, which are called cytotoxic epitopes, which induce a response of killer cells. They are positioned individual for each patient. Now, in reality, during the first year, many of these, although not of them, actually activated, are actually activated CTL response. Altogether, out of those guys, and there are dozens, I said, 5 to 25 mutate. So perhaps, I don't know whether it's half or third, but not all of them. On average, 15. Most of them within half a year. And interesting, that time gap between escape is gradually increasing with the number of escapes. Furthermore, each epitope doesn't have just one escape mutant, but a whole bunch of them. Most of them are single and double mutant, but only one is fixed in the end. And CTL clone number against different epitopes is increasing. And these are data which you already shown in Alan's talk. Mike Michael's group, first author Gunatilike, published in 2009, where boxes show those are actually diverse sites. Boxes show diverse sites associated with epitopes. Dashed are predicted epitopes by anchors. Solid are actually observed CTL responses. Red show early, black late. So we have, as you can see, we have lots of early going on, and that's what I meant by, and this is days, 0, 16, 45, 11, 180, 400 days, so a little bit more than a year. And this shows percentage of escaping, of dominant escaping mutants, from up to down. Okay, that's pretty much it. That's one patient, that's second patient, and this third patient, different numbers between 5 and 25. So we do have, that's, and many escape mutants, as I said, are observed by deep virus sequencing, as shown here by very poorly, I would say, sampled points, but they were interested in depth rather than frequency, time frequency. The blue shows wild type, copies per mil, the rest show escape mutants. So many escape mutants are coming at once. And what is black? Total mutant.
Virus load.
I think it's virus load, yeah.
Oh, total virus load, correct. Right. So those are 1, 2, 3, 4 epitopes in 4 different patients.
Yes. The first 4 letters of the patient.
Abbreviations.
Right. So many. Up to 70, as I said, observed. And that's Turnbull, Persifon Borough group, shows CTL clones against different epitopes. Epitopes are shown right here. The stretches of amino acids, for some reason, they're kind of too long. They're certainly too long because they're supposed to be shorter. I don't understand why.
Are those just test peptides that they're using?
Because
they don't know exact epitope. They say 15 long peptides and make every possible one.
It includes epitope.
It includes.
Okay. All right. So 10 of them. So in the beginning, this is virus load, and those are different epitopes. In the beginning, there is just one raising up, then second, third, fourth, and in the end, you have many of them, as you can see, in 200 days. Same tendency in that patient, and that patient, and that, and that, and that patients. And those patients in which one dominated, I cut off.
But is this...
They're out of there. They didn't see.
Do these include double mutants? I mean, is this really this wave mode that we see, or is this more like classical...
This is number of clones of CTLs recognizing specific epitope.
So these are really, they're not kind of spreading inside each other, but they're really competing at the same time.
Without mutations.
Without mutations, wild type epitopes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
They're recognizing different wild type epitopes. In addition, each of these, thank you for this question. In addition for each of these wild-type epitopes can have multiple escape mutants. Those CTLs are not shown here.
Okay.
They, in principle, they exist. And those were, that is one epitope, multiple escape mutants per one epitope. And those are CTL against many different epitopes. Okay. So we have many escape mutants per epitope and many epitopes, to make problem more interesting. And it's interesting that the slope of escape, and the slope of escape is measured by fitting the increase in leading variant to that sigmoid curve, according to various authors, is 0.3 for the earliest escapes and goes to almost none within a year. And
so what is the slope?
Slope is when you fit one locus deterministic theory to increase in leading epitope escape mutant frequency.
That's so it's essentially how fast it rises?
Right.
Right.
The epsilon is slope.
Yeah. Okay. So
now
it's the same as exponential growth.
Right.
So it's something like a selected advantage.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. That would be S, right, if that would if that theory would literally apply, mechanistically.
Okay.
But it doesn't, of course, but it's still an important bioinformatic tool to measure slope, so you can tabulate data, compare them later without each time going to data. So, and that is done. And frankly, our models typically predict epsilon slightly larger than one if there is a full CTL pressure on the site, even slightly larger, actually, not 1.3, 1.4. No, in fact,
what,
it's...
What time units?
It's assuming generation one day for eclipse phase, one for productive phase, average product.
So per generation, what generations are taking?
Per generation. Yeah. No, productive phase.
Arbitrage were days.
One day.
Generation times about 2 days.
Did I say 2 days? No, productive phase we took shorter. It was approximately 1 day, just as a zoom.
Yeah, I don't know how you got your predicted
upside. One. We did everything first, but we read the literature. So it's epsilon is, right. Right, in days. Day is generation. Right, and that's what's interesting. So slopes decrease, and furthermore, they're below what was naively expected if CTL applies full pressure at a given epitope, which is what is normally expected, if they go consecutively. And major players here, depletion of target cells, it's so-called avidity, or sensitivity to antigen of different CTL subsets, and of course, mutation costs. If you would have to invoke mutation costs in order to explain it from the point of view of literal one locus theory, so to say that epsilon is actually one, that immune pressure is actually one minus S, then S would be tremendous. It would be on the order of one, you would have, because you need to cut it three times. So we used somewhat cleaned and simplified model by Hausdebor with updated parameters, which is just basic standard dynamics of target cells. In fact, Alan showed it yesterday, except we have different sequences with different fitness, each with its own mutation cost, added over escape mutants. And sequences can be whatever, once again. I can only repeat it. Go from target cells due to infection or die or being killed by effector cells which recognize. And there is also small mutation term from other sequences. Mutation can occur at one side at a time. And the very simple dynamics for effector cells, it just says that they reproduce at a rate which depends in some smooth threshold way with some characteristic threshold of infected cells which they can recognize. So the simplest thing. And you can accommodate into this framework multiple escape mutants per epitope or one escape mutant per epitope, does matter. So the funny thing that all parameters here, are, because the model is so well studied for the last 15 years since it was introduced and used heavily more by Alan Patterson and his collaborators, that we know already everything here except for viabilities and mutation costs. That we can play with. So this is the idea that if of the threshold, that if we order epitopes in order of increasing abilities, CTL thresholds, antigen thresholds. So most sensitive epitopes is ordered 1, then 2 and 3 and so on and so forth. And that gives incorrect predictions. Such an initial beautiful model gives absolutely incorrect predictions. Yes, it gives consecutive escapes. What we assumed here is that one epitope mutant per epitope, no mutation cost. I will explain in a second why. And we explained that geometrically increasing antigenic thresholds, 10 power 7 to 10 power 9, just equidistance in log, why not? And adjusted the gap so that I have 7 escape. What happens here is the consecutive escapes, yes, they increase in time. The gaps increase in time, and here you have virus-producing cells with one mutation, with one and first and second mutation, triple mutant, quadruple mutant, 5, 6, 7. So consecutive escape, alternating, and this is a one-side frequency, and those are absolute cells. That's the difference. And CTL numbers, each time escape occurs, CTL go down because they are no longer stimulated. Nothing, and then all this ends up when no CTLs are left. The whole point here is that as virus goes up to epitopes with higher and higher threshold, depletion of permissive target cells occurs. And finally, it becomes so low that virus cannot replicate even in the absence of CTLs. So no CTL pressure is left, first of all, and secondly, the number of CTLs decreasing to the end in direct contradiction to data. That's the problem. Not to mention that slopes are three way too large as compared to what is observed. So, and if you think that introducing large S helps with slopes, no, because once you introduce a mutation rate which is larger than 5%, things get only worse because you don't fix the slopes. But instead of it, wild type rapidly comes back at sites, and we have a steady state and stable polymorphism, balancing selection instead of full escapes. So playing with mutation rate makes things worse, not better.
Selection?
Yes.
Better selection.
Yes. If you assume mutation cost, because that was without mutation cost. I assume mutation cost was zero. If you introduce large mutation cost, things get worse. We have a stable polymorphism instead of full escape, as observed. For most sites. For some sites, it is partial escape, but for most, it is full. So we have to fix our problems. And we have two ideas which seem to work, and this is a last slide, actually. So, and one is assume that there are clusters of epitopes, especially, say, in the beginning, which have similar thresholds. So we have distributed pressure, especially when time goes. There is a distribution of thresholds which kind of converges to some limiting point. Maybe that is responsible at least for smaller slopes. But how do you explain increasing time gaps between escapes? Work the other way around. So it's not that easy. So perhaps interference of mutants within and between epitopes simultaneously slows down escape, and interference within epitopes slows down escape rate, and interference between epitopes causes these delays. So it works differently within and between epitopes because different mutants within one epitope recognized by the same CTL, and those so it works differently, right? You need multiple to escape all of them. And turns out that this idea seemed to work partly. So you can obtain small escapes, and you can obtain delays, small, slower. And we have simulation examples, which we are happy to show, although the work is progress. The summary is that one locus model certainly doesn't work, although remains a valuable bioinformatics tool. Constant selection pressure is, well, I will list it out. Actually, generally speaking, doesn't work, but may work in a time interval for epitope clusters. Now, mutation cost is small. It must be small in order to explain anything. Order of escapes is set by these thresholds. But threshold ladder should do something interesting. It should converge up, and we should use up interference and distribution of CTL pressure so that we will have more and more delay and smaller slopes as time goes. Now, depletion of T cells, which featured heavily, is not that important, because when we go for depletion as a major player, we end up in concluding that CTL don't control HIV, and it's perfectly known that it does, from CD8 depletion experiments. And of course, we need finally to replace our deterministic simulation with a simple cutoff by the correct models, which I discussed in the theoretical part. And I would like to thank my true student, Rebecca Batorsky, who's been with me for 2.5 years, doing a great part of the work, starting from the literature in Enigma with analytics and simulations, and my collaborators who provided me with sequences, as well as financial support.
Is there any hint whether real HIV goes in beta much larger than one or beta much smaller than one? Like, whether, is there any, like, or is it more like about one? Like, how much recombination in terms of
in stationary regime?
Yeah, or, I mean, if these models have any, yeah, I mean, right.
You mean a stationary regime, assuming that, well, we are discussing.
Okay.
So some opinion is being developed, so it would be...
It was interesting that both Boris and Richard have modeled their model, of course, in light of HIV, and your better, much smaller one approach as well, right? So,
right.
And which one is the...
So, Richard, what is your opinion, if you wish?
Well, my opinion is that there are these general models which give you an idea of how to think about sort of the problems. Mm-hmm. But then when you go to the data, you know, you really have to see what the data is trying to tell you, and then sort of...
Yeah, we actually didn't progress that far. The truth is we're trying to fix the theories. We fix them, we will try to apply them. But the one thing I can tell you, when I tried to run theory with constant S and apply it to data, I obtained nonsense. You need distributed S, because in the case of fixed S, many parameters depends very rapidly on recombination rate, many. And once you distribute S, this rapid dependencies disappear and become flat. So before we get to that stage, theoretical, I mean, so I know that from simulation, which I understand like experimentalist, but intuitively and poorly, but we need to fix theory first.